Yes, sir. Reading you loud and clear.
Ask a rocket scientist.
7 years. Fuel on it. Go. 4G. 5.5 cabin. Oxygen. Go. All systems are go.
Welcome to this week's episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist. My name is Chuck Woodford. I am here with my friend Bill Scaff.
Hey, Chuck. How's it going?
Going just great. Bill is an actual rocket scientist, and I am an idiot. So I sit down with Bill from time to time to answer pressing science questions that I have, and also to answer questions that you have that you submit at our website, iHeartRocketScience. So if during the course of this episode you have thoughts about what we're talking about, I make a glaring mistake and Bill doesn't correct it, you can on the internet. You can just let us know. Give us some feedback at iHeartRocketScience.com. So, Bill, once again, you are currently working on the Orion spacecraft.
Right.
Do me a favor. Give me a little update. How's that going?
So, we're doing well. We're well into the second mission, the build and launch preps, actually. So, EM-1, which is Exploration Mission 1, it's actually the second flight of Orion.
Again with the acronyms.
Sorry.
EM-1.
Yeah.
All right. You're going to have to dumb these down. This is not going to stop with this episode, you understand.
No.
The rest of our relationship
NASA-ism.
Together.
NASA-ism.
Yes.
EM-1.
You're going to have to explain these to me. So, go ahead.
Yeah.
EM-1.
So, EM-1, this is NASA's name for these missions. That's Exploration Mission 1. And this is it's still a flight test. There won't be astronauts on board, but we are, the vehicle is physically built. They're starting to bring bigger pieces together. So as we're doing all these preparations on the spaceship, parallel to that, the rocket's being built. So Boeing has the SLS, which is another acronym,
mm-hmm.
Space Launch System. Really big rocket. I think a Saturn V from the Apollo era, big.
So in essence, you're putting
together.
The Lego pieces together.
We are. That's where
all the Lego pieces are arriving in one location.
Right.
It's time to start clicking them together.
Right.
And the rockets will fly.
And the rockets run a little behind. So whereas we thought we were going to have this flight in 2019, it's looking like they might push it late 2019, 2020 now.
All right.
But they're not letting us slide the mission after that, which conveniently is called EM-2, Exploration Mission 2, which will have astronauts on board. So what you're going to end up with, two missions really pretty close together. EM-1 is the test flight to prove that all the equipment's working before we put humans on board. Then EM-2, which will actually take astronauts to the moon. Both flights are going to the moon.
Yeah.
Just one with people, one without.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, there's a reason why I just asked you, because a little bit later on, we're going to be talking about the movie First Man, the new Damien Chazelle movie with Ryan Gosling about Neil Armstrong. I went to go see it, and I've got questions. And so we'll talk about that in a little bit. But that's what Bill's up to. Bill's going to get us to Mars, friends. He's getting us to the moon and then to
eventually,
Mars.
Eventually. We've got to start somewhere.
Okay, so we're going to start the episode the way we always do, with a story ripped from the headlines. I saw that astronauts survived an exploding rocket.
They did. And
can you give me details and explain to me how in the hell did they do that?
All right. So this is, in the space world, this is a big deal.
I think in any world, surviving a rocket explosion would be considered a big deal.
crazy thing. Rockets don't always work. So mid-October, there was a Soyuz launch. That's the Russian capsule that's been ferrying astronauts to the space station. Had two astronauts, an astronaut and a cosmonaut on board. And as the rocket was climbing out, the first stage worked. So if you think rockets, you know, there's the bottom part of the rocket's first stage. It did its job. Second stage was supposed to light. Something went really wrong.
Oh, no.
It's a bad day. It's a bad day when things go wrong on a rocket. The amazing thing is these capsule systems do have the ability to basically jettison the capsule off. Just get it off and away fast. It's not a pretty ride. It's going to hurt.
Yeah.
But when you got a rocket going fireball underneath you, you got to get away quick.
Sure.
So it did. Basically, it just flung the capsule off. We have what are called abort systems. They're solid rocket motors. They light very quickly. They are violent. They burn for about 3 to 4 seconds and get you, you know,
Safe
downstream.
Distance away?
Yeah.
Okay.
Horizontal and vertical distance away. They just get you away. And that's what happened. And
because it seems like, finish telling the story. The astronauts survived.
Yeah, absolutely. So they now gravity takes over the capsule, just goes into this big arch. Arc and comes back to Earth. It came parachutes deployed normally, landed 250 miles downrange in I think highly unpopulated Russia.
Hopefully.
For Kazakhstan, right.
Hopefully right. Unpopulated.
Well, it's not like, a giant airplane landing. It's a space capsule on parachutes. So
well, that's actually something that I learned a long time ago when I was first paying attention to the U.S. space program, is the reason why we launch from the Cape in Florida is because when the rocket goes up, it travels east, and if anything happens, it's going to detonate out over the ocean. It will nothing bad can happen over populated land when we launch from Florida, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So generally, it makes sense.
Generally, it'd have to be a really weird, windy day and something blowing up right away that would bring it back on land.
Which is kind of what the situation was in Russia, where they had to abort. Fortunately, there weren't shrapnel and flaming rocket chunks landing in housing developments.
Right. The rocket, when things went wrong, this was up. So they haven't given a lot of the nitty-gritty details. So coworkers, of course.
Weird, coming from Russia. How's
weird,
not getting all the details from...
So as rocket scientists at work, we were talking about this, and we think when they said it was a ballistic return, we think it
which
was
means what?
Enough. It basically just like, I hate to make this analogy, like a ballistic missile, it gets itself up there and it just follows the arc.
Like one of the nuclear warheads.
Yeah.
That we were terrified of in the 80s and 90s.
Absolutely. So we think they might have been high enough that they'd actually gotten rid of the primary abort system, which is a small rocket which will launch it off. Orion has one, Apollo had one, Mercury, Gemini, all had them. It might be they were going so high and already getting close to the edge of space that they just unhooked the capsule, kind of flipped it off as opposed to having another motor launch and get it away.
Got it.
We're not quite clear on the details, but essentially, we think they were high enough, they were close to the edge of space, they had to just ride out the ride.
Ugh.
Came down 250 miles. Downrange and
sure.
And go ahead.
So first question that I have is, when something like this goes horribly wrong during a launch, is there an automatic abort? Is there somebody whose finger's on the button back in mission control? It's like, oh crap, and then they hit the abort. Are the astronauts doing it, or is it all systemic? The system realizes something's wrong,
right,
and fires the.
And that was in the news blurbs on this story. They said it was automatic, and Orion's automatic too. If there's certain things that go wrong and trigger certain signals, it's just like, nope, you're out of here. You're not going to even get a choice in the matter. You're just going to suddenly find yourself getting shaken crazily and wake up later. Originally, the Orion abort motor, it doesn't fire for that long, but you're accelerating at crazy speed, and it would have astronauts will black out. Mm-hmm. In some of these events, briefly. They're going to come to like, well, wait a minute, I'm not in space. I'm on my way down. What are these parachutes doing?
Right.
All right. So it's a violent event. They said the Soyuz experienced about 7G sustained vibration.
Which, do me a favor, equate that to a typical rocket launch. Equate that to our day-to-day lives.
Okay. So when we say something in term of G is like 7Gs, it means you're feeling 7 times the force of gravity. And so we've all been on roller coasters when they kind of pull up at the bottom and you feel like you're heavier.
Yeah.
Well, that's, just a fraction of a G. Now, take 7 times your weight pushing down on you, and that's what they were experiencing, sustained vibration during the event. So it can be violent.
And that lasted for how long? Like the 7G pressure weighing down on them, is it like a 5 or 10 second thing? Is it a 4 or 5 minute thing? Is it all the way to the bottom until the parachutes pop?
No, it's, I would imagine it was pretty limited to, you got your abort event. So, let's say, I'm just spitballing here. If you got 10 seconds of an event that's really shaking you hard, then you're tumbling a bit, the vehicle will try to right itself. And then things are more stable and it's more like a normal reentry.
Yeah.
An interesting thing we were talking about at work, and I think it was even one of the news blurbs, Soyuz capsules automatically want to go butt end down. Right, okay. So it automatically wants to ride itself. Think like a shuttlecock.
Like a cat landing on its feet?
A cat when you play badminton, the little birdies.
Shuttlecock. Call them.
Yeah. Okay. I said that. I wasn't sure if that was right. So it wants to automatically ride itself, but the Russian capsules are much steeper. Like, they don't look like a big capsule. They look a little more pointed. The U.S. versions are a fatter capsule, and they don't always want to come out stably. It depends on where the mass is. So they have thrusters automatically help spin them to the right way.
Got it.
So I think it's a little more mechanical solution, I guess, to try to make sure they're turned and flipped the right direction.
Okay, so rocket goes up, mishap, automatic systems fire, we assume, according to the articles that we've read, pushing the top part of the rocket where the astronauts are. It's similar to what we know from the Apollo mission, the Gemini mission, where there's a giant cylinder filled with gas, filled with fuel, at the very tippy top are where the humans are. So as things go wrong below, something blows it away. And because it, the thing that blows my mind in this situation is that when something like that detonates, you don't know which way the shrapnel's going to go or anything. So you're just hoping that the abort mechanism pushes the inhabitants far enough away quickly enough that as an explosion may happen, debris and shrapnel isn't piercing the capsule.
Right. And that's the intent. And then when they're on ascent, too, they're in pressure suits. So even, you know, even if you were to have a small puncture in a pressure vessel, at that point, you know, they've got pressure suits protecting them, and ideally in this case they're still in the atmosphere even though it was very high up, right? So they're coming back down pretty quickly. They're not having to survive an orbit with a punctured spaceship.
It's just a fascinating story. So then that brings the question, has this ever happened before? And I guess, you know, we don't know a whole lot about the early Soyuz flights because back during the Cold War, Russia wasn't telling us a whole lot. But I'm wondering if you know if things like this have happened in the past.
Russia had one other where they used the abort system, and this time the rock was looking like it was going to go ballistic, big kaboom on the pad. So they actually did have, there's a video of a Russian commander hitting a button in the control room to get the astronauts off. And that one does fire a small rocket under the capsule to get it away. That's the only other one that I know of with humans on board. The American systems, the Mercury, the Gemini, the Apollos had the ability to do the same, but we never had to use one, at least that I know of. We did flight test them. They were tested. I don't, as far as I know, we've never had to use one with a human on board. Shuttle did not have an ability to board off the rocket.
And that's something I want to talk about, but I'm hesitant to talk
about.
Because it's of the accidents, both Columbia and Challenger, the way that the craft is designed, there was no way for the front crew compartment to separate from the rest of the plane, the craft, the shuttle. So in that instance, did they have an idea that the shuttle itself could immediately separate from the solid rocket boosters and the fuel tank, and or was that not even an option?
From what I know of the shuttle, it was never intended to be able to board off a rocket. It couldn't do it fast enough. And plus, the shuttle itself had rocket engines on it. So if those were the engines with the problem, you can't get away from your own vehicle. So it, as we learn, and unfortunately, this is one of those hindsight moments where they tried very diligently to engineer out the problems from the shuttle. But things still go wrong. I mean, you've got enough energy on board one of these rockets. You know, they're nuclear bomb levels of energy packed in liquid hydrogen and oxygen. So when they go bad very quickly. And that's part of the reason when NASA went to the Orion program, they said, no, no, it has to be a vehicle that we can abort astronauts off of.
And oh, by the way, hi, Marlon. I don't know if you can hear Marlon, the kitty on the other side of the room. That's our sound engineer. That's Marlon. And so obviously that was a requirement because of the horrible lessons that we learned with Challenger in particular.
And so what they did, without saying it maybe quite that way,
it's so sad, Marlon, I know.
So the different companies that were proposing or submitting proposals for Orion, some of them were winged vehicles. Lockheed Martin's original proposal was a winged vehicle. And NASA, you know, about a year before the proposals were finally due, said, nope, we want capsules. And in their mind, the capsule came with all these other inherent capabilities. You can put abort systems on top of them. You can put abort systems underneath them. You can do many things to get a capsule off. And it's not that you couldn't do that with a winged vehicle, but I think in their mind, the capsule was the overall safer approach.
My goodness, it's just a fascinating story. And the fact that the two survived and how quickly they were jettisoned from the exploding rockets and just and that whole story. There is video. You know what? We should post a link to it.
We should.
On our website, iHeartRocketScience. There's a plug. Yeah, so if you want to see what this actually looked like, I haven't actually seen the video yet.
There's some clips from the interior.
All right, I got to check it out. We're going to post it on iHeartRocketScience.com if you want to see it. Just look for the show notes for this particular episode. Okay, well, that's fascinating stuff. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, it's time for one of my favorite segments of the show, Science or Bull. We're going to talk about the movie First Man here in a moment. Today's episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist is sponsored by people that are different than me. You know, it's so easy, especially on social media, to just surround yourself with like-minded people. Yeah, in real life, it's good to know people that aren't like you. Maybe they think different political views, different, I don't know, skin color, different nationality. Hang out with people that are different than you. You learn so much. I don't do it nearly often enough. But when I do, I come away smarter, more empathetic. And we could sure use a lot more of that, right? Hanging out with people that aren't like you. What a quirky idea. Okay, back to the show. Welcome back to Ask a Rocket Scientist. Once again, any questions, comments you have, direct them to our website, iHeartRocketScience.com. Also, leave us a review. Like if you get us from the iTunes store, yeah, just tell us what you think of the episode. It helps other people find it, which we would appreciate. Time now for a segment we like to call Science or Bull, where we take a look at movies that are either currently out or classic films and kind of analyze the science in the film. And so since First Man came out recently, the Ryan Gosling movie about the life of Neil Armstrong, I wanted to talk to Bill about that. Bill hasn't seen it, right?
Nope, not yet.
Not yet.
My two attempts to see it both failed.
Were they aborted at launch?
Thanks, I'm wrong.
Thank you very much. I'll be here all week. Okay, thank you. All right, well then, I will ask the questions, because coming into this movie, I knew an awful lot about the Apollo 11 flight and you know, a lot of flights leading up to it, but there were still a lot of surprises. Like, for example, the movie starts with Neil Armstrong as a test pilot, taking, I don't know what the jets were called, what the PF-4793s, whatever they were, you know, being dropped from a plane,
yep,
launched,
yep,
into the upper reaches of the atmosphere. There are multiple times in this movie where not only do I get claustrophobic, but I get dizzy because of the shaking camera. Like, mm-hmm, the way that they show the vibrations in multiple crafts, multiple scenes, it's just mind-blowing. And to watch him, pre-astronaut, fly a jet at ridiculous speeds to ridiculous heights, and just watching how the entire plane is just shaking, it's just dumbfounding. And so, can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So, I'm going to flash back to another one of my favorite space movies, The Right Stuff.
Perfect.
And so, Chuck Yeager, they kind of use a similar... Now, mm-hmm, I haven't seen First Man, so I'm analogizing it to a movie I have seen. But in those days, when they were trying to seek higher, faster airplanes, you know, they were using large aircraft to carry them aloft, you know, save the fuel, because they were basically rocket planes. Mm-hmm. So they dropped them, light the rocket, and away they went. Those planes, when they have solid rocket fuel, essentially, they're rough rides. They're shaking. They're violent. It's not like the jet turbine you're used to. It is really a rocket back there helping them get up to speed. Mm-hmm. So loud, noisy, shaky.
Yeah, it's one of the remarkable elements of the movie for me is being in the cockpit and feeling what that's like. And then the other thing that I just want to mention real quick is I mentioned claustrophobia earlier. I do get claustrophobic. Like, if I'm in a very tight, confined space and there's not air blowing on me, I get freaked out a little bit. Years ago, I went to go visit my friend Rick. He works at Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. And they had a mock-up of the Apollo craft, where it was open and you could, that had the three seats and you and two other people could sit in it. I think I've got a photo of it. I'm going to post it on the website of me and my friend Rick and my other friend Danny. We are not small people sitting in those seats. It's incredible for me to comprehend the fact that three grown men sat side by side for a ridiculous amount of time without being able to stand up or move or even wiggle their elbows, or, you know, they were just there. Yeah. Seated.
Yeah. Well, they were able to fold those seats up. That's one thing you don't see a whole lot. And when you see the static displays, as the seats folded up, they could extend standing up lengthwise, kind of pointing down the tunnel, the docking tunnels. And, mm-hmm, and Orion has the same capability too. But you're right. If you're strapped in your seat the whole time, you'd go loony.
Yeah. Well, because they show the movie then goes with Neil Armstrong's movement into the Gemini realm. He was on Gemini 8, mm-hmm, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so he and Ed White, side by side for the whole duration of the flight. It was going to last, what was it, six or 7 days? Yeah. Something like that? And those...
That was it. Yeah.
You get into the ship. Yep. You sit in your seat. Yep. 7 days later,
yep,
you get up from that seat,
yep,
without moving.
Yeah, that was not Apollo. Yeah, that was definitely a single seater. The seats were not foldable. If you read, you know, we read books like even Mary Roach's Packing for Space, and they refer to those missions in the Gemini era because there's two astronauts. Yeah. You know, the astronauts would joke that they knew their teammate better than either wives, because right? You got to do everything right there in front of your teammate.
Right. Well, because you never sit next to your wife for 7 days straight.
No.
There's always something going on. Yeah, that book, Mary Roach, Packing for Mars, that's definitely worth a read. But one other quick thing I wanted to talk about with the first man that I was really impressed with is the training of the astronauts. They put them in that little rocket that they spin around.
Oh, the centrifuge.
The centrifuge. And then they also put them in the ship, the little tester thing, where they're just in a seat and it rotates all three X, Y, and Z axis. Mm-hmm. And it's spinning in an uncontrollable way. Right. And you have to right the ship before you pass out. Explain that a little bit, because you're rotating and you're not going end over end, you're going side over side, end over end, and it's incredible to watch. And so this plays a role later where Neil Armstrong is on Gemini 8 and they start to tumble, and he has to figure out how to stop it. It's just fascinating watching this happen.
Well, take yourself back to back before we had men in space, and we didn't know what traits you would need.
Yeah.
Right. So they were basically. And again, the right stuff, another movie, similar tact, is they didn't know. So they just set this really high bar for physical capabilities.
Yeah.
And you're right. In space, there's no gravity. You don't have a way to right yourself. So they were natural instinct would say, okay, let's find people that might have a better ability to use their inner ear gives them a stronger orientation sense. They can use that to detect if they're tumbling, turning, mm-hmm. swirling. It's interesting because, we now know after the fact that those traits aren't necessarily what enable you to be in space.
Right.
Everyday people have gone to space and been just fine.
Yeah.
But
to pilot, to be in charge of the craft, having that ability obviously proved itself to be of paramount importance with Gemini 8 because... And so for those that don't know, this is something that I learned earlier. When you are in space, there is no friction. So if you start tumbling, you will never stop tumbling. There is no way the atmosphere, the lack of atmosphere that you're in doesn't slow you down in any way. So you'll just tumble and it will never stop. If you saw gravity when Sandra Bullock gets detached from the arm, she's just going to spin for the rest of eternity unless somebody's able to come out. George Clooney's able to stop her. So when this is happening in the movie, like I brought that knowledge to, I was like, oh, well, these guys are screwed. He needs to figure this out. And as history tells us, it's not much of a spoiler, because he does end up going to the moon. That might be the spoiler. He does survive Gemini 8, but in a fantastic way. And the way it's represented in the movie is, it's just mesmerizing.
I'm going to turn tables on here, Chuck. I'm going to ask you a question.
All right.
So you came into the movie knowing the Apollo story.
Sure.
Was there anything you didn't know already going into the movie?
Well, the as I hear people that have seen the movie critique the movie, they say that Ryan Gosling just has kind of a completely blank face and blank expression. There's not a whole lot of joy or emotion. And people are kind of critical of his lack of emotion. Now, I knew that after Neil walked on the moon, he didn't do interviews. He kind of backed away from the publicity. He didn't want to do interviews. He wasn't like Buzz Aldrin. You see Buzz Aldrin still out there all the time doing interviews. He's hilarious. Neil is not that guy. And I didn't really know that. I didn't know that he was so insular, that he was so, reserved and so kind of quiet and cerebral and totally focused on his job. I mean, his relationship with his wife and the kids, it's fascinating to watch that play out. And I knew that he didn't want to have a whole lot to do with the spotlight after. What I didn't know was leading up to it, that's been his personality for his whole life, is he was just very focused on his job. He wanted to do his job to the best of his ability, regardless as to what that job was. And the one thing I would love to know, though, that I don't really know is after... Okay, I'm going to go back a little bit. This is what I learned when, about 20 years ago, John Glenn, when he went up on the space shuttle in 1998, I learned that after he orbited the Earth in the early 1960s, John F. Kennedy blackballed him from ever flying again. John F. Kennedy said, John Glenn will not fly in space again because he's a national hero and we can't afford to lose him. And I thought that was fascinating. So John Glenn, this guy who's trained his whole life to be an astronaut, all of a sudden is like, what?
His career just ended.
Yeah. So then, however many years it was, 35 years later, he got to go on the space shuttle as a 70-year-old man, and they ran tests on him as an elderly man to see what that was like. And so what I wonder is, with Neil Armstrong, once he walked on the moon, was he done? Did he say, all right, well, that's it. I can't do anything else. Or was he like, no, what's my next ship? What's my next flight? Can I do Skylab? Can I, you know what I mean? Or did he just walk away and say, okay, we're all good here?
Oh, man, that's interesting. I don't actually know.
Yeah, so that's something that I would like to, you know, it's funny when you see biopics like this. Usually at the end, there's a little crawl that says, Neil Armstrong went on to do this and this and this. There's nothing like that. He goes to the moon, incredible sequence with him and Aldrin on the moon. And then the movie kind of ends. It's like, okay, well, that's it. That's the story. And I just wanted that, maybe a little bit more of a postscript, like...
Yeah, that's interesting, because...
Because he doesn't do interviews, we don't know.
You don't know. And the astronaut corps was a tight-knit bunch.
Yeah.
And there weren't that many Apollo astronauts.
Yeah, and you get to see his relationship with my favorite astronaut of all of them, Gus Grissom. There's something about Gus. I just loved him. And so his relationship with Gus Grissom and his relationship, obviously, with Buzz and with Ed White, a very dear friend of his. Obviously, they flew on Gemini 8. So, yeah, so there's all these little dominoes that kind of fall, all these little interlocking pieces that connect. And it was just great to see. So, so you and I need to go see this movie.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you have to think that his persona, you know, is the ice in the veins persona.
Sure.
If you think of pilots.
Well, you think of the movie Top Gun, you think... That, you know, they've all got ice in their veins, but they're also super cocky.
They have to have swagger, right? Because it's part and parcel. I think you got to have the confidence.
Yeah.
But
by watching this movie, I didn't see that in him. Ice in the veins, but no attitude. It's okay. Like, I am emotionless. Okay. We're going to get this done, but I'm not going to be cocky about it. I'm not going to go out later to the bar and start picking up chicks with my swagger.
Right.
No, this is what I do. It was fascinating.
Huh, so, interesting.
Yeah, so really enjoyed First Man. So as far as science or bullshit goes, well, I'm going to call that all science because I don't know what they got wrong, if they got anything wrong, and Bill obviously doesn't know. He's no help whatsoever. So I'm calling science on this. I think it was a very accurate depiction. Now, if you picked up some things that weren't 100% accurate, please let me know at our website, once again, iHeartRocketScience.com. Give us some feedback. All right, one more quick break, and then we'll be back with your question. We got a question from one of our listeners. Today's episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist is sponsored by that moment when you and your significant other make a pact not to get each other anything for Valentine's Day, and then you stick to it. Yeah, no expectations. And it's not one of those things where it's like, we're not going to get each other something. Then, of course, on Valentine's Day, she ends up getting you something awesome, or I sneak and get her something because, no, you agree. It's not going to happen, and it just doesn't happen. I mean, maybe you make dinner plans, but there's no big stigma that it's got to be the most romantic dinner ever. It's like, let's just go out for ribs. Oh, ribs. Yeah, so making plans not to get each other something for Valentine's Day and then sticking to it, yeah, that's fantastic. All right, back to the show. Okay, welcome back to Ask a Rocket Scientist. Okay, now we have a question from one of our listeners. Butch Farber from Brookfield, Missouri, sent us an email. This is funny. He says, I saw a story recently online that giant black holes are merging. What the hell? Should I be concerned? Butch, that's a very good question. So we did a little bit of research. I found an article online. Bill did as well. And apparently, yeah, scientists are finding these massive black holes that are getting close enough to one another that are they sucking each other into one another or are they orbiting each other? Like, can you explain?
Yeah, and I'll preface this by not my specialty here. So I read an article just like Chuck did, but
what's great is you understand the articles. Where I'm just like, I don't know what 70% of these words mean. So this is why I'm asking you.
Okay, so here's my take on it. Galaxies are roaming through space, and they pass through each other, and so it goes to reason that eventually, black holes are going to do the same thing. They're going to pass.
I want to interrupt for just a second.
Okay.
Because this is something that we don't think about in our day-to-day lives, is the fact that every single thing you see in the sky is moving.
Right.
It's constantly moving. We aren't just orbiting the sun. The sun is also orbiting the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Every single thing we see. So So our perception is the sun is a stationary thing and we're all just looping around, but that is not true. And so, so I have to remind myself of that, because the perception that I have, all the animation that we ever see is just the sun.
It's very Earth-centric, right? Yeah, and Hubble has caught some absolutely spectacular pictures of galaxies passing through themselves.
That's incredible.
And so we'll have to see if we can find some, put them up on the website.
Sure.
But stunning photographs that mm-hmm. can give you a real feel for these, you know, we kind of, I think most people have a image of the Milky Way, like mm-hmm. picture the Milky Way passing right through another one, wow. another solar system or galaxy, right? Mm-hmm.
So anyway, okay. So with that being
said, you know, everything in space is passing through other parts of space. And so what these articles talk about is how, okay, this does happen with black holes as well. And you get two normal black holes, you know, the underachiever black holes, they pass close enough to each other, they pull into each other into what they call a binary orbit. They're spinning around each other.
Got it. And is this a permanent thing, or do they slingshot? You know how sometimes two things will come close and then capture each other's gravity, and that pivots them around each other and pushes them away?
Right.
Or is this the type of thing where they are, oh, these two are now, in essence, married. They're going to do this orbiting dance for eternity.
Right. And so I think they're massive enough, they keep pull each other into this orbit. And it sounds like from the article, eventually they will kind of pull themselves into each other. But for some time, amount of time, they're spinning around each other. If you think of those, gosh, like, I forgot what these little toys are called. It's like the two steel balls with the cord connected between them. So they're constantly just spinning around each other, mm-hmm. that sort of motion. And what's tip scientists off to this is really going on is that once this happens, these black holes are emitting X-rays and signatures that we've been able to pick up on since the 50s. And that's how we originally first identified the black hole existed. Except at that point, my vague memory here is that it was Einstein hypothesized they have to be out there, but we couldn't see them until we figured out what to look for.
Right.
So this article talks about...
And what we needed to look for was an absence of everything.
An absence of everything. But then they also, as they're, I guess they're sucking everything in, they emit certain radiation, I think.
Got it. X-ray. So our eyes couldn't pick it up, but scientific instruments could pick up radio waves and things like that.
Right.
Okay.
And that's where this article is going, is once they go into this binary mode, they are emitting what they're calling jets of... I'm not quite certain what these are emitting at this point, but it's the same, you know, some sort of radiation that then, because now they're spinning around each other, it's kind of like a beacon flashing.
Interesting.
And so we can pick up on this very even beat.
Pulse.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so it's one of the tip-offs that this has reached the phase where they're circling each other. Now, as far as what says they actually get pulled into each other, I don't know. The article never really states how this terminates.
Okay, well then let me ask this question, because this goes back to a conversation we had a while ago when we were talking about Interstellar. As far as a black hole goes, things orbit black holes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
they do.
Like, black hole has enough gravitational pull that things are trapped in an orbit around. So when these two get together, I mean, obviously, I know that there's a vast amount of space between objects that are orbiting in space, but is there collisions? Like, do you think that as the black holes get closer together, obviously they're pulling everything that orbits them together as well. Right. And so do you think one day that just emerges into a massive black hole with... now twice as many things orbiting, or do you think a lot of stuff slams into one another? Or
that's a good question.
I think it'd be
chaotic.
That's
no matter
because
what.
I'm dumb and I want to know these things.
We need an astrophysicist. Where do we get one of those?
I thought I had one here.
Isn't Neil deGrasse Tyson on your speed dial?
Yeah. No. Yeah, because I wonder if this, you know, is anarchy in the skies now. I mean, is this, as to Butch's question, should we be concerned?
Right. Well, I don't think we're in danger of a black hole sneaking up on us and you know, passing anywhere near us anytime soon.
Kind of like Jaws.
Exactly. You hear this? It's like, dun,
creeping through the universe all of a sudden. All right. So what you're telling me is when a boy black hole and a girl black hole fall in love, they could turn into one giant supermassive black hole.
That's what they call them. Yeah, something even bigger.
Okay.
They get together and make one big black hole.
Thank you for putting in terms that I understand. Okay, so Butch, apparently we don't need to be concerned, but yeah, what the hell? That's a really good question. I'm also incredibly intrigued about the concept of black holes merging. Thank you so much for the question and bringing this article to my attention. So as we wrap things up, Bill, what did we learn today?
We learned, let's see, we started off with how amazing it is that we can get astronauts off an exploding rocket.
Yeah, it's insane.
That truly is an amazing feat, and they're gonna fly. They're gonna live to fly again.
Yeah, whether they choose to or not.
Right.
After surviving that.
Right. We've learned that Neil Armstrong was something I didn't even know. It's like you don't think about it, but his persona really does disappear after he lands on the moon.
Yeah. What happens to Neil?
Right. Well, that'd be a great movie.
Searching for Neil Armstrong.
Exactly. And finally, black holes. What little I know.
I said this in the very first episode of the show. I'm going to say it again. Don't with black holes, especially when they're super massive black holes. Stay far away.
Yes.
Okay, well, that wraps up this episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist. Bill, again, I cannot thank you enough for hanging out, answering some of my questions. Once again, if you do have questions or you have comments about the episode, you can find links at our website, iHeartRocketScience.com. You can also add some comments and quotes on the website, or like I say, feel free to comment at the iTunes store where you download the podcast. There's a place to put your review. Let us know. You hate it? Do you like the show? What are you thinking? Because we'd love to get some feedback. Seriously, positive or negative. I'm really good at taking criticism. All right, Bill, once again, thank you very much, brother. We'll do this again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Chuck.